brought to you in Cardiff. No, not because I want them to. So I'm looking at the agenda, slightly revised, and some of you might like that. I still did a procedure earlier agenda, and may have seen the copyright on. It is no longer there, as you will see, we're focusing on debt. Treasury could not be with us this morning, but will be here sometime. And then we have all the issues that we've been carrying because we didn't have a quorum. And I'm looking at our situation now as we talk. So we will, I understand that some folks caught a later bus. I think if you've got a 9 o'clock meeting, the villages are problematic with transport, so it's wise to get the 10 to 7. Important to say them so that you are here on the time and others did make it. On that particular note, that we have someone, and I should just add, it's not my intention to drag the meeting. If we can finish at 12:45, we will, but for the moment it's 1 o'clock. Can we please have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda? Make Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable Mark Tush. And it was for that reason, incidentally, Honourable Charlie, that I didn't email you some documents I promised, because I didn't have access to certain things, but they are fully available today. We then have the apologies here. We have certain late apologies. Honourable Briani will be here for the first time in a long time, from his medical leave. But arriving late. Honourable MacPherson's plane was delayed, he will be arriving late. But I imagine they'll be here about 9:30, maximum. And so, I think those are the only apologies we have. We have an apology from the Honourable Elder. A medical apology there. All right, what about the Honourable Yesterhaven? He is at energy. Right. And then we have others who are back after bereavement, as well as studying and so on, like yourself, Honourable Sanguini, and great to have you back with us. So on that note, we swiftly move at 9:10 to feedback on issues raised by stakeholders on the committee bill on debt relief. But while we are there, a full advocate and whoever comes in, Mr. Herman, at one point we did a timeline on debt, you will recall. A lot of members asked me, please, where is it? Now, I thought I filed it under my timeline, but I clearly didn't. So would you email it to all of us again? You know, when you did a timeline up to a particular point.
Chairperson, I can do the timeline, but you're also preparing a phone of the members, which is yeah. With all the information since we started the process.
Yeah.
Until today, until today, up until today, but that will probably be very nice for the week.
Yes, I'd like mine in terms of the timeline today. Right. Now, we've got a couple of people who need to assist us in the copy and the debt relief, and that is Parliament's senior advocate Charmaine Van der Merwe, who's crafting this for us. We also have members of DTI, the Deputy DDG, Mr. Matthew Kinsey on the PCRG, Consumer Corporate Regulation Division, Mr. Stephen Mungler, I saw you, the Acting Chief Director of CCRD, and Ms. Kariyashi, the Deputy Director. The National Credit Regulator, I'm just looking to see where they are actually. Ms. Matsudar, oh, right here, thank you. Mr. Tongwani, Deputy CEO, and Mr. Bulbeni, I've never heard of Bulbeni before. Is that Bobby? Ah, about that one. Thank you. That is the senior legal advisor. The MCT has formed, you know, our data. But Professor Lefeco, chairperson, and Mr. Bosch, the chief operating officer, and Ms. Ruby is a senior case That's where the people we have. Some of you have already signed in. But I would like us to get started. Can everyone be down there and hear, I think, advocates as well? Are you going to talk? Thank you.
Not an agreement, or you will give me this and then we negotiate on what I'm going to say. At the end of day, it's an obligation, and you must say that. So that is also not a prayer agreement. So all of those things in any event fall outside of this measure, because we can only influence the credit agreements under this act. And that deals with the site presentation as well. The reserve land presentation, I think the only really interesting and useful, I mean everything was useful and interesting, but the thing pertinent to this bill was the offer to do a quantitative impact study. And I know that the committee was, that is part of the process. In fact, I think once the bill is done, DGI has indicated that they'll do that through the socioeconomic impact assessment process for the committee. But I think the focus of the reserve bank might be slightly different, might be very useful for the committee to consider that offer. The last presentation is the one where I want to focus quite a lot on, because Justice really gave very, very important and useful comments. So I want to go through them, and I'm not going to touch on everything because they, a lot of their slides actually just repeated what is in the bill, so I'm not going to do that. But, and the slides, I don't know, the printed version that I've got aren't numbered, but it's the fourth slide. It starts with section 88A continues, and that is in the red print. On that slide, they speak about requirements and regulations being four to be replicated for consistency. And regulation 24 deals with information regarding personal details, income, expenses, and so on. Now, the answer to that is that that is in fact replicated in that the minister will prescribe those information. So we have made provision for the minister to prescribe the type of information that is required, how you will determine personal information, your proof of income, and those things. So there is provision made for the minister to prescribe. So the minister will probably do something very similar to regulations 24 in relation to the SMEs. But that, of course, is then not for this committee currently to consider in relation to the bill. They also suggested a definition for once-off debt relief. My problem with that, and I thought very long and hard about it, is that the definition is going to be the debt relief measure contemplated in Section 88A. That will be the definition. And I don't think that is what they mean. And it's something that we have been struggling with, because what is the debt relief measure? But if we try and pin it down, it becomes what it is in the bill. So there's no need for a definition. It is clearly spelled out in the bill. If we go broader, then we're walking into the territory of the prescribed measure, which is also very clearly identified in the bill. So it becomes a bit of a difficult thing. It is something, if members want a definition that I can think about, I'll have to talk with DGI and credit regulators and see if we can maybe get something together. Currently, I do not see the value of the definition. The definition is where something does not have an ordinary meaning, where you either add something, so your definition would be for purposes of this part, for instance, a bottle of water would include a draught of water. Because normally if you talk about a bottle of water, you expect a bottle of water to take a draught. Or you would say something in the definition, table means anything that is in a triangular form. Because normally with a table we have a square or rectangle in mind. But if we for the bill want to say, no, that's not what table is going to mean, we mean something that's triangular, then you will define. So in other words, either you add to a word or you take away from a word. That is when you define. If it means what it means, you don't have to define. So like I say, I can take instructions for that, and then I will have to sit and have to just apply our mind to this. But I do not see the value that would add at this point. I might be wrong. I'm happy to accept that as well. They made another comment in relation to capacity. I think that is something that this committee is very much aware of, capacity of the regulator, capacity of the tribunal. It is something this committee has discussed. I think it is still under discussion. It is something that is being considered. So I'm not going to go too much into that. The next slide that I want to talk to is the sixth slide. It starts, Section 88C provides for. That is the slide that I want to speak to. The crux of what they are saying there is that they are concerned about the participation or the lack of participation of credit providers in the application for this debt relief measure. Now, the tribunal actually made a very good proposal that the process is finalized and the credit provider then only be given an opportunity to state the case. I have, in the draft that members have received, made provision for something like that. I looked at the magistrate court rule, I looked at the high court rule, and I took from that what seemed to fit. Because we are actually creating process. There isn't a similar process elsewhere. Someone mentioned that we should look at administrative law, but my problem is this is not administrative in nature at all, and I'm worried that we miss something because we take the administrative route. We are definitely affecting constitutional rights, property. We are affecting, that decision must still be taken, but even during the process, the person should not be applying for further debt. So we are affecting their status and saying you can't enter into an agreement. So those are not the kind of things that you want to deal with on an administrative level. The tribunal is definitely the right body, or otherwise the magistrate court, but we've already talked, we don't want to go that route because of delays and so on, and not even having oversight over court. So at least this will give the committee oversight of but this will not give the committee oversight. The committee has oversight of the tribunal, which allows the committee then to at least follow up on the process. But I think from when I read on the bill, I think members will see it much clearer. The process would be once the order is granted, it must be served on the credit provider. And then between the rules of the two courts, I've taken one of the rules which says in that sense it's now a respondent, but yes, the credit provider may put the matter back on the roll for hearing the option. So that process is there, they can now be heard, there is provision made for them. So I think we addressed that, in my view, adequately, but there is still consultation that will take place with the Republic, and we'll consider any comments there. In respect of Indukum, I don't want to give too much feedback because I fully agree with what Justice said about Indukum. The fact that provision is made for it, that there is a common law Indukum that applies, that the National Credit Act amended that common law provision, made it much broader. The outstanding question then is the issue of lawyers' fees. And as I understood, Justice will come back to this committee on that question, because that is the crux of the concern around industry. The next slide, we jumped a bit now to slide 12, because she went quite into detail in industry. It is a slide that starts with any other concerns pertinent to the draft framework bill. The first bullet point there is related to the Office of Chief State Law Advisor. I think that this comment was probably made because the Department of Justice was not aware of the recent rule changes to the National Assembly rule. The service provided by the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor would be to certify an executive bill, and in doing so, to certify and confirm, in other words, to Parliament, that the bill complies with the norms and rules of drafting convention. Also, that the bill is constitutional. With the latest rules amendment, Parliament has actually placed that duty on the Chief Parliamentary Legal Advisor, there was a process where legislators drafting capacity was created in that office, specifically with this in mind, to assist committees with committee bills, to assist members with private members' bills. Now, the chief parliamentary legal advisor, or a legal advisor designated by him or her, which in this case will be me, will have to certify that this bill complies with norms and standards, and as well that it's constitutional. And because with committee bills and private members' bills, there is a risk that there could be less consultation, less awareness of what the executive is doing. There is also a requirement that the parliamentary legal advisor must certify that the bill is aligned to the greater statute book. So it's actually a bigger obligation, if I can put it like that, that is, or a broader obligation that is placed on the parliamentary officials than is on the chief state law advisor. So that comment is noted, but the response is that is absolutely provided for. We fully agree it must be done, but it will be done within Parliament. This process is of course only necessary just before introduction, because that is when the bill must be ready. So that certificate will be issued. And if I have any concerns regarding drafting style, regarding constitutionality, regarding clashes with other pieces of legislation, in this consultation process is where I will highlight that to this committee. So I am concerned about this, I am concerned about that, and it's because of with that in mind, because it has to be certified. So we do take that very seriously. The other thing that I mentioned still on that slide is regarding the definition of the applying one. I think it kind of speaks for itself the way the definition is structured, but I did add the word one in the bill so that it's quite clear, because it also came up, I think Treasury also asked that question in one of their presentations. The definition of child-headed household, I've made it much broader now in the bill, so it is not just where the parent or legal guardian is dead, but also where there are other problems, missing, disabled and so on. They did ask the question about whether we should not include households where the people are elderly, households with the women at the head, or persons with disabilities. I will need instruction from the committee on that, because I thought about it and I looked at what the criteria levels are. The problem with child-headed households is not that the person, the child heading the household would not have entered into a credit agreement. It is something that is passed on to that child because the parent is missing or dead or became mentally disabled. In other words, it will most likely be incidental death where the parent maybe went to a store, bought some groceries, the idea would say at the end of the month, and then died, and that debt then becomes a credit agreement. So that was how I understood why we include child-headed households, because a child being a minor cannot enter into a credit agreement, so that credit agreement will be illegal in any event. So it can only be those kind of things that come down on the shoulders of the child. Whereas with disabled, the elderly, women heading households, I thought if they fall within the income bracket of 7,500, they will qualify in any event. We do not have to specifically say that they will qualify, because if they earn only 7,500, they will fall in that bracket. But like I said, if something is made for the committee to consider and give instructions, if the committee agrees with that. Then the next slide 13, they're talking about realizable assets. I've looked at the Magistrates Courts Act and I have tweaked our definition so that it includes most of that. When we go through the bill, there is one paragraph that I will just highlight for members that I am not convinced about including. And when I asked Justice what do they think is meant by that paragraph, the answer that I received to me means that we should maybe not put it in. But I'll rather speak to it when we get to the bill. Just to say that I have incorporated it, but we need to also still apply our minds when it is relevant to our goal. The issue of retrospective on is not retrospective. So the fact that there is a date cutting off agreement does not make our bill retrospective. It means that the debt that qualifies on a date in the future has a certain shelf life where we provided a couple of dates. So that does not make our bill retrospective. The tribunal is not going to look at the person's income expenditure at the time when they entered into the agreement, except for the fact that already as far as it's provided in the act in relation to reckless lending. But that is something already provided for, so it's also not retrospective. So I think maybe afterwards I had a quick chat with Ms. Kitzelay and she understood what I was saying. And also in any event, even if it was retrospective, I think the committee members made it very clear what the rationale is for that type of debt. So, but like I said, it is not retrospective. We do not have to concern ourselves too much about that concern from their side. She then talked about a list of the asset affordability assessment. My problem just with the affordability assessment is that it is something that the committee could probably consider. The same goes for the list of factors to make a just and equitable order. But what these deal with is emolument attachment, which is not what our measure deals with at all. So in other words, when a court makes an emolument attachment, the court must see whether the debtor can afford to pay that amount. That is not what our debt relief measure is about at all. It's not about affording. So I don't think that it is relevant to our bill as such. Then also the guidance given to a court, and it talks about things like the size of the debt, the circumstances under which the debt arose, our alternatives and so on. Our measure already makes provision for alternatives. The reason why we have identified our target group so specifically is because from what the committee's consultations have shown is that that is a gap that does not qualify for debt review. So their debt relief measures are almost non-existent. And so we already say that you must look at the current alternative. That's there. And then, in fact, the committee went further, and I think this was, we looked at what Treasury was saying about instead of giving a discretion to the tribunal which order to first implement, the progression is now, if you qualify, it is suspended for 12 months. Perhaps the time period can still be the time, but it will be suspended. After that period, or just before it expires that period, there will be a review of the person's financial circumstances. It might be suspended for a further 12 months, or it will be extinguished. So there is a clear progression, very little discretion. So the guidelines talking about circumstances under which the debt arose, I don't think that is relevant to our measure. So I have looked at it. I think it was very valuable input, but it does not really affect us in our role. The next slide, slide 14, there's quite a lot on that slide as well. In respect of the oversight from the NCR to the tribunal, I don't think that I can give that answer. A lot of members have mentioned the need for monitoring evaluation, and I think that the credit regulator needs to maybe assist in how that can be done. If we need to include it in the bill, then we need to include it in the bill. If it can fall under current measures, then we don't have to provide it. We know that it is already provided for. So it isn't valid, but we need some input there. The second point is just provision for the credit provider due to oppose. We've already spoken about that. The determination of the maximum interest, fees, and charges. She mentioned that it looks like the Indigrum rule. It's not the Indigrum rule. It was more related to debt review. And that is what we still have. So the idea is more a person could be referred for debt review, but if the tribunal sees this person will not be able to afford that that process. But the person can pay some money back, then the tribunal can step in and make that determination. The financial literacy and budgeting skills, this committee has already commented on that. And the provision is now, it is one of the discretionary orders that the tribunal can make. It could be a condition. And we require the minister to prescribe something. So once that is set up, then that can happen from there. So the second to last slide, but it's the last slide with consent, ordering of clauses, speaking about effect versus duty. The reason why I kept the heading of the section effect of ones of patronage was because I compared the rest of the principal acts, which in the sense of justice they now would not have done. Sections 84 and 88 speak about the effects of something, and then they give a similar kind of content. So when you draft, you try and keep the style of the act, so that whatever you insert reads well with the rest of the act. So I kept it effect. If members feel we should make a duty, we can, but just to explain what the rationale behind that was. A process for notification, because we now have that process where the creditor can come back, there is definitely a process made, provision made for that. She made a mention of the provincial credit regulator. That was simply an oversight from my side. I had it in the bill initially, and what I thought was, because the Act provides for provincial regulators, and I thought that one of the concerns we had was how will people be applying. And if there were provincial regulators, that would really assist greatly, because then you spread the workload. But the credit regulator confirmed that there currently are no provincial regulators. So I took that out, and I think the one that remained was just an oversight when I deleted them. And then the last comment was about the minister, when prescribing, the fact they said that there is no process for the minister to come to Parliament. But I think they might have missed a last subsection, because the minister is required before he actually publishes to table a report in Parliament explaining the comments that were considered and what was done with those comments. And those are the things from justice, like I say, very, very useful. In the bill, you will see a lot of this input reflected there. But just on some of those, either further instructions are required, or I did not think that they were relevant to our goals.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Beth. Remember, those of you who may not have attended that meeting, and we would like to welcome you back again to the committee, Honourable Biyani. And hope that, you know, you are now more effectively healed and so on. Thank you. When we're looking at the first one, and we got the apologies from both yourself and Honourable Chesko, that was our feedback from the advocate, Linda Mirva. We want to, at this stage, it may be quite useful, any clarification you seek, in particular those who did not, you know, attend the meeting on that particular day, because this was a very crucial input. And the committee was really appreciative of a number of the amendments that had been made by Justice. Those acts, they are acts, pieces of legislation. That really has taken us forward. So if you need clarification, there were two or three areas we were concerned with, but now we've heard that perhaps we need not be, just as an example was the one about the elderly and this and that, but as Advocate Vandenberg has said, problems, you know, they'll be taken care of if they early get those 750. So do we need specifically to say the elderly and disabled? Do we need to say that? And I think that's the issue. Yes, Honourable Williams?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, with regard to that issue, I think that because we've defined it as people who earn up to 7,500 rand a month, then anybody underneath that falls in automatically, and perhaps we shouldn't define anybody at all. We should just say that anybody that earns up to 7,500 rand a month. And so, because if we start defining and then we forget about one category, then it's going to be, you know, it could be problematic there. So I think that the 7,500 rand should be the overarching principle here. And we should just leave that in place. And then anybody who falls underneath that qualifies, and that it should be that simple, including child-headed households who shouldn't be earning any money at all except for grants. So that's what we should go to, I recommend it.
Any other comments or clarifications in the sport here? Yes, Honourable Bill Williams.
Thanks, Jane. Thank you, Officer, for the feedback. It really helped with our budget for 2 weeks. Thank you.
I think they're just testing the panel off. Oh, yes, 21,000.
Carry on. And you were speaking on remote. Yeah. I think it's a very good sign, Jay. Not a predict what 2019 will be when we are doing the inauguration. So it's a good sign. And it goes off when I'm speaking. Thank you. I just want to check with the advocate as well that she said that she feels that there should be no definition on debt relief within the bill. I think we should include it, Chair, a definition. If that is what you have said, I think we should include it and make it very clear within the bill as a definition. Because the reason why we are also doing this, we shouldn't shy away from it, is that we want to, you know, give people relief on so I think we shouldn't leave it out. It would sort of, I think, give a loophole to individuals that have taken advantage of it. And then the one of the 7,500 check, I'd just like to know, like, how did we come up on that amount? And I remember on the beginning of the year, we did also get presentations on, I think it was from National Treasury, on public servants and how suggested they are and so forth. So if we're going to limit it to 7,500, and which category are we looking at? So are we going to not exclude those individuals as well from what we are trying to do as well in terms of debt relief?
I think you make a valid point that some of us have joined at different points in this committee, in this area, and it's important that as we go forward, we all need to be on the same page. So that is appreciated. Thank you for those comments. Honourable Mantash.
Good morning, Chairperson. Thank you very much. I think for the first time we have done it for a public that we need not categorize people on this matter shared by the level of income. Because at this point, many of our people before that were present are in a financial constraint position, especially to the but I only have two Chairperson observations, and I would plead to the committee to insist on the Reserve Bank to present to us the assessment, the qualitative assessment that we are supposed to have given us, and also the Department of or the Treasury. I'm worried about their not responding to our request and have not given any answer to our request, Chairperson. Because for me, these are the two bodies that need to give us direction on what you're trying to do. And I would say that we press on them to comply. Because they are a part of the government and they need not be treated like a certain entity in other words that we don't need to.
reference to that you were referring to a song of the South African Labour Union people, because I think all members of the committee were quite surprised and put it mildly at the approach to our questions. Although I must say, towards the end, the penny dropped and the responses were more in keeping with where we are, what we are pursuing. But I think Mr. Herman was just saying, suggesting to us, or to me, that look, we can always bring people back. You know, just because they've been once doesn't mean it's goodbye. We may need to unpack certain other issues in this regard. And while I think the SARS has very different, you know, mandate perhaps to most of the other sections of government, nevertheless we have one constitution and one public service, etc., etc. We need all to be mindful of that. Can I see another hand, Honourable Munskalbeck, just before you come in? Honourable Macpherson, we did get your apology about the flight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think to start with, Chairperson, on the issue of bringing back organizations or entities if they are not satisfying us, it's not always, I think it's not always the solution. Because if they are dead person in their perspective, we won't change their perspective. We might as well, if we found clarity, we might as well move on and look for other avenues. Instead of doing the same thing and we won't get the satisfaction that we get, it's just going to give us the same information again. On the other issue, Chair, I value the input on the broadening of the child labor household.
Yes.
Because it was of particular concern to me, especially the fact that we find children in households who parents died, but we also find children in households while their parents are alive and not capable of maintaining the household. And I'm specifically thinking, Chairperson, even if we are mentioning mercy or mentally disabled parents, I'm also thinking about parents who are incapable of handling their households because they are because of substance abuse or any other related medicine. So if that scope can be broadened, then at least we'll be able to assist those children better.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to talk again to the definition of the once-off debt relief, and I disagree with my colleague that it should be defined. I just want some clarity around that. Why, advocate, you don't think it should be defined, and what are the implications of not defining it? Because the question, my colleague was correct that there might be some abuse to that, but if there's an absolute reason where it shouldn't be defined, that makes it more advantageous outside of definition for our people, then you know, I'm keen that it doesn't get defined. So I want clarity around that definition. Should we define it or shouldn't we define it, and what are the advantages and disadvantages of doing that? Thank you.
Thank you very much. The Labour Department, my right, the UIF, also engaged with us there. And I still have a question, and I'm concerned about the information we received from them that, well, you know, I think one of our questions had been around the data, the integrity of the data, etc. And they made it very clear that the UIF data depends on the information submitted by the employer. Now, I think that everyone sitting in this room has had some experience of when their information is incorrect, submitted by the employer. And I'm not sure what their response was I was looking for my notes here, but perhaps the advocate, Van der Merwe, you would have made a note of that. And just see if you can help us in that particular issue. Because at one stage, this committee was, unpacking whether or not we could ask Labour to consider utilising the UIF to, support financially resource this particular bill. That was our initial views on this. And is this thought possible given their statements, as it is Van der Merwe? Do we have any other questions or comments on this? Anyone?
No.
I think we'll go straight back to yourself then, Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. The first thing that I just want to actually maybe just get some clarity on is I'm not sure if we the category that we are targeting, if we should simply say people earning up to 7,500 and then we remove the definition or the reference to child-headed households because that would automatically fit in there, which I agree with, that would automatically fit in there. Or if we should keep them separate and even further maybe tinker with that definition. So I'm not sure we could do both, but I do agree that they would fall within the category of 7,500. In respect of the definition for literacy, our bill already in our preamble sets out what it is that we are trying to achieve. So, in a definition, we would not say what the definition is trying to achieve. We would say what it is. And if I have to put a straightforward definition into this bill, I would say the measure contemplated in Section 88A. In other words, I don't add. I simply refer to a specific section. The other option would be to say that a debt relief measure is something that alleviates household debt by way of suspension or extinguishing or considering capping of interest. In other words, listing what we already have in the prescribed portion. So what I was simply saying is that I don't think a definition would add value. Having said that, As a draft, I wouldn't like to include a definition that doesn't add value, but I don't think that it is something that would create a loophole if it is in or isn't in. So it really could go either way, but like I say, unless we want to do something specific with that definition, I cannot think in my head how to word it other than how it is currently worded in the specific section. So that is why I said I don't think they add value. the next issue is then that comes back to the concern about whether we this is quite a big one. In fact, the question about the public servants, because they would earn more than 7,500. What happened was we looked at the presentations received to date. At that stage, there was a statement from Treasury in one of the presentations that people, in order to make use of debt review, you had to earn 10,000 or more, otherwise you couldn't afford it. Treasury's number was quite high in comparison to other presentations that we had. But at that point in time, we then thought, well, let's do the 10,000 because that is what we're looking at. Treasury, however, in their next presentation said, no, at the time when they made that proposal, there were other things that they did not have sight of, etc., etc. So their number came down to 7,500, which correlates with one that we got from, I think it was Debt Busters, who is a debt counseling company, who indicated people
2,500 below is simply not cost effective. They can't afford the debt review. And I think there were one or two other numbers as well that indicated 7,500. So that's the number that we are currently on. And then when this bill is published for public comment, we might receive other information that might then tweak that number, but that is currently what we're looking at. So the reason for not looking at public servants is because your public servants would probably fall in that, no, not probably, if they earn more than 7,500, they would fall under the debt review cap. So there is a measure available for them. They will qualify for debt review, and I think it was quite a strong view around the table that the Act is a very, very robust document that must be made use of. So there is debt review measures. The problem just is, because not everyone can afford that is where our bill, that's sort of the gap where our bill fits in. So that is why we did not look at people, I think, public servants. I think they do fall under the police and the military and so on, the study that the Treasury did for them. But we did not look at them specifically. We measured it on the gap that we can't afford debt relief. So the issue then is just to understand between Mr. Carlbeck and Mr. Williams in relation to how Charlie's household, if we accept that they fall in a 75 category, or if we want to specifically say something about them. That I just need an instruction on, and I can do that. And like I say, I don't think that there will be a problem either way. The one thing that I am a bit concerned about, though, is how I've worded it currently is to say a child in his household, yeah, is, if you want to put it in the bill, it would be page 9, means a household where a minor is responsible for the management of a family unit due to the mental illness, death, or other prolonged absence of his or her parents or legal guardian. So I focused on a situation where it is quite easy to ascertain whether the child is managing the household. I am a bit worried about how we will prove that a child is in fact leading a household where the parent, for instance, is an alcoholic or a person who abuses substances. Because that person may have gaps where they are earning money, where there is money coming in, or the money might be coming in, but all of it is used on alcohol or drugs. But how will that be proven to the credit regulator? So I'm not saying that we shouldn't include it. We need to just keep in mind that currently we have kind of whittled our application down to a tick box thing almost. Whereas this kind of investigation, you might have to contact social services to do an investigation first, which will delay, because that kind of thing can take months to confirm what is going on. Outcome might also then be rather that the children are taken away so that they won't be qualifying anything. So, it might be preferred, I don't know, but I'm just saying, keep in mind, you can put it in, but it makes the application verification process a bit more difficult for the regulator. The issue about the quality of information of their database, they did acknowledge that. What they've said is that they do have some proactive measures as well.
Yeah.
So there are some proactive measures. I think we will have to accept that a database is only as good as the people who insert the information. That is always the risk with a database. But there is a reason for Labour to have this database, and I don't think that they wanted to have incorrect information, because that is just payout, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems that, in fact, that Labour, as I understood it, it sounded to me like external consultants who are, in fact, doing checking for them. So it seems that they are working on improving the database. The one thing that they could, in fact, that they agreed with, is if someone is not formally employed, then that information would not be with them. But then I think as a committee we also need to accept that could then be a circumstance where the credit regulator might have to follow a different avenue. So I am checking, I'm the national credit regulator, an application comes in, this person says to me they are earning 6,000 rand. In terms of our agreement with Labour, I quickly go into the database, I can see the person there, I can see he's employed by Charmaine Motor Vehicles, and I can see that Charmaine Motor Vehicles is paying him 6,500 as he is paid. Confirmed. So this application is done. Then I get to someone else who says, look, here I give you my bank statement, or my post bank statement. You can see that I am running a vegetable parlor, shoppy or something, and you can see my income is 3,000 to 4,000 rand a month based on my statement. Then they know it won't be on the Labour database, but they can look at other backups for that. Person might not have a bank account. It becomes more and more difficult to ascertain. And it might be necessary at some point, if you look at the Labour database and the person isn't there, at least you know the person isn't formally employed. So already that is a tick box. So, you know, there are negative confirmation that can help you to ascertain as well. And then they talked about the UIF to support the bill, and their response was that the UIF focus is something different. And so that is why they would not, I don't think that it was necessarily an outright refusal to assist, but I got the impression from the fact that the objective is a different objective, that they would not necessarily be in favour of that.
Mm. Right, thank you. I think there are a couple of follow-ups. Did I see your hand on the table a little bit one more? Did anyone, a little bit person, do you want to raise anything at this point? No.
I don't know what was discussed.
No, but the thing is that you were there during the presentations, weren't you, on last Tuesday? Am I correct?
If anything
you needed clarified, do go ahead. All right, it was Honourable Williams, secondly Honourable Sanguini, Honourable Van Skalkveld. In that order, please.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, with regards to child-headed households as defined, I just want to know, there must be a definition of child-headed households in other legislation. You know, are we not using that definition, the one that's all currently existing?
Mm.
Because if we come up with a new definition, then surely we'll then be clashing with the other definition. So I just want some clarity on that, whether or not it is defined elsewhere. And if it is, then can we use that definition? When it comes to the who we're aiming at, I do think clearly that we weren't aiming at necessarily civil servants with this legislation, and we were aiming at the poorest of the over-indebted society, because of the fact that if we want to include everybody, the country can't afford it. We must be realistic in our expectations of how much money we expect the banks or the financial service providers to write off or to get rid of. And if it's a big figure, it could do some very devastating effects on our financial system. So we must be realistic. I mean, I'd love to write off everybody's debt, but you know, the implications might be completely, you know, unacceptable. So we must be clear about we're aiming at the poor people, not at necessarily civil servants. So we must really be clear about that. Thanks, Jim.
I would like to know from Honourable Williams, what are we defining poor? Like, that public service that is so poor, like they, when they have taken out loans, and especially as flexible loans for educational purposes and all of that. So what do you define as poor? You get public servants that can't even pay a university tuition on the thing. So. So we need to really define how to define poor. Then the one that I wanted to come in chair, it was the child-headed household. I agree with him that we need to look at other legislation, how well did they define it, and then it needs to be put in. And then I think the one of the debt review one of the public service chair, I think I'll maybe postpone this for some other time and engage more in it. Because it's also a broader spectrum that we need to engage on the debt review side as well.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you have debt counselors, agencies that are having people with standard 6 giving a person with a degree how to manage their debt.
Mm-hmm.
So that is also an avenue that on a later stage that we need to look into it, how we're going to assess and so forth. So I would request for Honorable William to define to be the word for.
Thank you, Honorable Sanskalpe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I also think in terms of UIH, Chairperson, in my other life, I'm on the side, Chairperson, and I think it's specifically the UIH mentioned that it's not within their mandate. The law doesn't allow them to fund any other thing. So we don't want to be, or we don't want the perspective to be seen as if UIS is sitting with a lot of money and they refuse to fund this initiative that's pro-poor. So I think I need to make that clarification first and foremost. The other issue, Chairperson, is with regards to that 7,500 public servants and all those things. What we need to take cognizance of, Chairperson, is there are some lower level public servants earners who will fall under that 7,500 bracket. And those we know if you're level 1 up until level 3 or 4, they are falling within that bracket. So I think we will be able to touch base in terms of the poorest of the poor, also in terms of those who are public servants. Thank you, Jesus.
Yes. I saw your hand up on all my first, is that correct?
Obviously, I wasn't here for the first half an hour, so I'm just going to pose some questions that I don't know if they have or haven't been answered. But if they have, if you could just answer them again for me. Advocate, I think the one place that I still don't know where this bill fits in, whether it fits in as a standalone new bill or whether it's an amendment bill. And I think that is derived from our uncertainty or non-clarity about if this is a once-off measure and if it's versus a continued measure. So I would just like your comments about that, because if it is a once-off measure, I think that it should be a standalone bill. Advocate, you'll recall the last time I raised the issue of legally granted credit within the defines of the National Credit Act. Now, how do we settle that issue? If someone has been granted credit, they have gone through an affordability assessment, they have met all the requirements, and that registered credit provider has granted them credit against that. What are the remedies for that? Because in my mind, unless a financial institution is completely unwilling to restructure that debt, I seem to think it would be somewhat unfair to then penalize and target the financial institution that they have done everything as required by law, and they are then basically having their debt expropriated. And so I haven't been able to resolve that question in my mind and how it's going to be answered. Because I think that what we fail to recognize is that financial institutions, have an incentive to restructure debt to keep customers healthy in the credit system, And I'll say it again, because I've said it many times, it is not within anyone's interest to pull people out of the credit market and keep them inactive for the next 5 years if they go through debt relief. Because that is the end result for anyone who goes through debt relief. I think our primary objective at every opportunity and the first course of action should be rehabilitation, not debt relief and to keep them out of the credit, to keep them out of the credit market. With respect to ministerial powers, and that obviously goes back to whether it's going to be a standalone bill or continued debt relief. I'm of the opinion, advocate, that even if there wants to be, even if the minister or the committee or the department wanted to have further debt relief, that can be brought in another bill. I'm still very, very uncomfortable with granting the minister prescribed powers. And then finally, with respect to the time period, have you given any indication on what the time period will be from in terms of when people can apply for and when that cut-off date will close? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lars, Advocate Van der Merwe, to respond to most of these follow-ups, a couple of other new ones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In respect of the definition of child-rearing households, the definition as it was in the bill comes from municipal legislation because that is where it is mostly used. It is part of the indigent scheme of municipalities. So I've used the definition. In fact, I think this one comes from Ekurhuleni. I made a note somewhere that where I got it from.
Yes.
So I have looked at it. It does not mean that we can't expand a little bit. What Justice gave us, I think, were valid points. And I had indicated as well, in respect of the municipalities, it differs from municipality to municipality. So I think that we're not really in a, we're not going to consume the legal system by adjusting our definition there. With Ms. von Kolbeck, I fully agree that the issue with UIF was about the mandate, and that's why I said the focus was something different. Mr. Pearson, if you speak of a standalone bill versus a different amendment bill, if it is a once-off measure, if this is a once-off measure, but there's no reason why it cannot be included in an existing act, because it is something that speaks to the National Credit Act, and it makes use of the current structures of the National Credit Act. There are also things in the Credit Act that have to be amended in order to make provision for this once-off relief measure. For instance, your credit bureaus and what they have to do, the records that they have to keep, the powers of the regulator, because the regulators, what the regulator does is very clearly spelled out. So we've included something there to say that they can consider debt relief measures. The register that they have, that it must include debt relief measures. So there's going to have to be amendments to the National Credit Act, and you might as well do it as part of that. Something that I am investigating, I have not included in the Act yet, in the bill yet, is something called the sunset clause, where we will provide that the minister may at some point publish a date in the Government Gazette, at which time that whole part will then be regarded as not in the Act anymore. So I am looking into that to see if that is an option for us to get rid of the actual part that is not on the list. As far as that versus the prescribed, I need instruction on that. That is a policy decision. That is not something that I can answer. If the committee decides that the minister should rather bring a bill, then I simply remove that section and reference to prescribed debt relief from the bill. In respect of the maybe we just answer your last question as well, in respect of the time period. That time period has not been finalized. The only period that is going to be limiting people would be the time, there will be a cutoff date in respect of when death was incurred. And that is the only requirement. If members want, we can say that people must, within 6 months from the commencement of this act, bring their application. That is possible. We have to think carefully about that period, so if we don't have to bring a further amendment to extend that for another 6 months because people didn't, people say, oh, I didn't know about it, and this and that, and following. So we need to think about it. That is a possibility. We can say you have a 6 or 12 month period in which to bring your application. So we can add that. But the only cutoff at this point in time is the date, and that we've got a couple of dates that we're looking at. The first date is quite some time ago, when this permission was granted for the school to be going ahead. A second date would be around the time of publication, the first publication of this bill for public comment, when the members of the public start knowing about it. And the third option is the date of commencement. So those are options currently. It could be any other date. We could throw a date in a hat and draw one. It's just a matter of limiting because it is one stop. And the fear mainly is that we don't want a situation where this committee is accused of having created a measure that actually encouraged people to go out and incur debt because they were hoping it would be written off. And that is why we're looking at a date in the past. Or once a bill becomes an act, it would be a date in the past. The issue of legally granted credit. The thing is here that, and that is why we need to be careful about how we work. So we have included something about there must be people who, and I think Treasury proposed, instead of saying you're looking at the reckless lending and affordability criteria, that you simply say 25% of income. So I have included that in the bill as a proposal. So it will not just be anyone who earns 7,000, everyone who earns 7,000 up to 7,500 that will qualify. It will be people who are in debt problems. And the same argument goes in relation to sequestration. Because all of those debts, those agreements would have been legally entered into. The person would have been able to afford it at the time. And then something happened in that person's life and they no longer could afford it. So with sequestration, yes, there is benefit to creditors, and that's what we look at. But creditors still write off quite a large portion of that amount. So that is the kind of, when I was drafting, that was the kind of picture that I held in my head. The fact that there is that, even with debt review, there are certain losses. I understand that when this measure goes through, creditors will simply be expected to write that debt off. And unfortunately, I do not have an answer to that, because that is the instruction that I've had, that there would be an extinguishing of debt. But we have built in things to try and get your debtor to comply, in the sense that there will be a 12 or a 24 month period to allow the debtor to recover and then start making those payments. So those are the kind of things that we have brought into play. I can maybe just also add that we have considered the systems from New Zealand, Wales and England, where there is no benefit to creditors there either. So that is the, if you can't afford, and in order to make sure that your economy is not hampered by people who never become contributing citizens, you give them this measure to assist. But I think a lot of your questions with all due respect are things that the committee will have to consider and answer, because those are very much policy considerations.
I would like to close off now, Honourable McPherson. So if this is not a new question, maybe we can leave it.
Just a question. just a point of clarity.
Yeah.
I think that.
I've got a follow up.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to know, Advocate, the sunset clause that you're talking about, who instructed you to look into this? Because I haven't heard of this before and I just want to know where it came from. Thank you.
Honourable McPherson.
Thank you. I think, I have no doubt that the outcome between from debt relief and sequestration is the same for a creditor. But I think the difference in sequestration is that there is a point of contact and there would have been a process leading up to that with the creditor and debtor to restructure and to make that debt work. And that for me is still the big concern, is that unless there is that space for the creditor and debtor in debt relief for restructuring or even taking a haircut or something to try and make that debt work, legally granted debt, it becomes problematic. And I think that for me, if there is still a legal question in my mind, Advocate, that's where the legal question exists.
Thank you. We're going to do a quick response from yourself, Advocate, because as you know, you're back on the floor after tea break again. So just quick response here, please.
Thank you, Chair. First off, Ms. Williams, the second defined set clause, that is called a drafting principle. So some of the things discussed, the issue of it being once-off, I think Treasury also mentioned about the standalone goal. So I started thinking about these things and what drafting measures I could bring in to counter, because it is still, I'm still of the view that the best position for this bill is within the Credit Act. If the committee instructs me to do a standalone bill, I have a proposal for that as well, because I have been thinking about that. So for me, it's about more about what can I do based on what the instructions. So I'm trying to pre-empt certain instructions because our time is quite short. So like I said, it is something in the back of my head. I have not had enough time to actually look into the sunset clause. My biggest worry is I think the sunset clause is more in relation to a whole bill rather than a part of the bill, and I'll need to just see if it can work. If it can, then at that stage I'll propose it. It's something to think about. In respect of the restructuring first and that process, it depends what the committee would like to. I mean, if the committee instructs, if we can add another step to this process, something to the effect that the debtor must, when he or she applies, indicate what was done in relation. We can add something like that. I will just need instructions, because at this point in time, like I said before, the application is really whittled down to a very straightforward tick-box exercise. But it could be that we need something like that, and then I'll just need an instruction on that.
Right. Look, members, I have said this a couple of times, but perhaps it needs to be repeated more frequently. This bill was always intended to be part and parcel as an amendment of the National Credit Act, and that was how we went to pass. But I think it's pertinent to say that having requested permission and the House, adopting our recommendation and enabling us to move ahead, the provisions of the bill are envisaged to provide great relief to over-indebted South Africans and limit the widespread abuse of consumers by unscrupulous lenders. But why a committee bill then? And bear in mind that this committee bill had full consensus. There wasn't a single party that disagreed. The National Credit Amendment Act proposes to tighten some measures related to credit. Despite this amendment, the Department has identified a number of new and continuing challenges, whole review efforts, etc., three-year exercise. A further review of the credit law confirms
is the need for the National Credit Act to make provision for the introduction of tax debt relief measures to further alleviate household over-indebtedness and prevent the widespread abuse of consumers by these unscrupulous lenders. Limits on the committee bill. Acknowledged in the request that the committee bill may not at this stage address all of the challenges that the credit law review identified. Although the department is also considering various debt measures, relief measures, the committee remains of the view that over-indebtedness must be urgently addressed and that it is vital that a targeted intervention not be delayed. We went on to say it would be important to establish criteria that would inform who are we addressing here. Is it the 7, 10, 20,000? Who are we addressing as a matter of urgency? Not saying that perhaps in the future it may be seen as advisable to raise this, but right now, what is the most pressing issue that requires that this committee address? And that is why it was then envisaged, and we went to the House on the basis that it was an intrinsic part of the National Credit Act, Amendment Act. This would be an amendment, if you like, that's in that. So we should not lose sight of what our intentions are at all. The issue of a standalone didn't even come into it, because if you are part of something, then you're not a standalone, you see. So I would really hope by now, members, you go back to our earlier decision as to why we needed this bill. Now, we will be engaging further on this bill after tea. So I am going to ask you just to put down your hand and to raise the issue that you wish to raise, Honourable Macpherson, after we've dealt with other matters that you may realise yourself we have not been able to deal with because it requires a quorum. And we haven't had a quorum until now. So we've been delaying this. It's more than a week now. So we must press on with these matters. And they are decisions on the terms of reference for the inquiry on the compliance with local public procurement and local... Sorry, I actually got a quite a bit cold through and localisation. South African Farmers Development Association. The terms of reference for the technical panel for the copyright amendment bill. Recommendations for persons to serve on the technical panel. So we need decisions here, we need a quorum. So I would ask you first to pick up the localisation one, as we call it. Have you got those terms of reference in front of you? Everyone? Copyright for localisation. All right. Now, these terms of reference were crafted together after staff had heard us unpacking this on several occasions. We have also issued these at various stages of their crafting. But this is the final document that we now have to pass a decision on, take a decision on. And really you can see the background, you see the policies on page one. Noted here. What is it we're looking at? The applicability, page two. The designation for local context. You will recall that our position was a lot has been designated, but it was very important for us to go back to those earlier designations. One of the reasons was operational, if you like. They got a track record. Didn't just get designated in 2016, but in 2012 and 13. What have you done in 3 and 4 years? We can see that. So that became very important. The committee process into this. It then does the track for you.
So you can go back to your own documents to check on this. And I really want to tell staff, I think you should tell Ms. Sheldon, Mr. Hermans, the researcher, I think Kwanda Magalani, I'm not sure if Mr. Medima was involved in this at all, but he may have been. And it's very clear, you can see on page 3, who are we engaging with? Why has this become such a concern? Because you will recall, those of you who were in the previous, here in the previous term of this committee, when public procurement could not achieve its intention of growing the economy and creating employment, the minister then looked at designating and said, now, this will work, I'll designate. This went through cabinet and his colleagues. Yes, we can't force the private sector to do this, but we can our own state-owned companies. So here's the designation that working with Treasury. So, of course, when we went on oversight, we were quite taken aback when we realised not even this measure was achieving what it intended to. And we see the track here on page 3. What is the purpose of this inquiry then? This inquiry is informed by Parliament's constitutional obligation to exercise oversight in the interests of good government. That is one of our primary duties, to pass legislation, to adopt legislation, to legislate if we so wish the committee bill, but also to exercise oversight over the executive largely, and of course the other entities, etc., to ensure that they do implement the country's legislation. The overarching purpose of the inquiry is to ensure that the localization and local public procurement policies underpinning the success of the Industrial Policy Action Plan are effectively implemented to achieve job creation and other economic development objectives. So what do we want to get out of this? To what extent local content requirements were complied with by government and state-owned companies within the contracts that were entered into and the delivery on them. We may learn, for example, but where the slip-up is in the contract itself. We don't know at this stage where it is. And so people can say, no, but I'm compliant with the contract. And we say, no, no, but we may have to then look at the contract. Is this is what is happening? Are the contracts inappropriately worded and designed not to achieve our objective? The reasons for non-compliance, it's all part of that. Appropriate legislative and other mechanisms to be effective to improve this. So we may come out of this and say, you know, the problem is we need a sentence in these contracts that says X. We need something else. So it may be that people would come here and say, yeah, I've complied. Now what are you asking for? But we hope they will come here in a more open and constructive manner. Because I would hope that every state-owned company agrees with us that government policy must be implemented. The scope of the inquiry, the moment there are many, many inquiries going on in Parliament, you know, you're tripping up on them. That's why we can't even get venues these days. So we don't, this is not, we shouldn't pursue something because it's now the fashion. Oh, we haven't got our own liberal inquiry. We pursue something.
Surely so, politicians aren't that interested.
Well, I don't know, Honourable McPherson, aren't you a politician? Answer it. As I say, proceedings for the inquiry will be open to the public. And the final report will be tabled. Just gives you the mechanics of it. However, evidence and the subject to confidentiality, and can I make it clear, everything we do when it comes to a bill or oversight is evidence. But suddenly now, people say we must use the word evidence. 23 years later, we've been doing that all the time. Why do you think people bring here? We just have a different approach to it than, say, justice. The inquiry will consider the designated sectors and sample a number of components, etc. And you see what we've said used here? It's important. We said and sample. We cannot hope to look at everything. Okay, clear. We're only going to do the sample, okay? This should include engagements with relevant stakeholders, etc. It may well include the analysis of original contracts. What are they saying? The committee will identify relevant government departments to consult during its inquiry. What is it? Where are the departments we're dealing with in this area that got them mostly involved? That's what we're dealing with. However, the committee's inquiry will be limited by a number of matters which are sub judice. We cannot for 1 minute begin while a court is unpacking something, we say, well, we also want to do that. Now that's just being ridiculous. It's actually also illegal to do that sort of thing. Planned activities. How do we intend doing this? We want to bring in everyone round about the 11th of November. And we've used this, you know, it may change depending on Parliament's overarching programme, but this is the plan, to bring them in. And the committee will determine the time frames of the inquiry, which will then begin in 2018. So what are we going to do on the 11th? I think it is vitally important, as we've done once in a colloquium, of bringing in these key stakeholders and saying, look, this is what we want to achieve. Do you have a problem with that? Or how do you think we could go about it? Why do you have a problem? So that people get a clear understanding that we need them to cooperate for us to conduct an effective oversight. And in that sense, they have a constitutional obligation to cooperate. But you don't. The day you invite them, threaten them with a subpoena. You know, you keep that strong ammunition in a box somewhere, and you only utilize it if you have to. So I'm hoping that we will get this cooperation. If we don't, it's there anyway. You know, it's in the rules, we can. All right? So we're going to have, and you can see there, it's SPRASA, OEM, Research on Compliance, Technical Industry, Site Visits. Someone had suggested that it may be necessary on an occasion. We can't conduct a whole lot of site visits. Let's get that clear. But it may be necessary. What are the resources that are required? But before that, at the top of page 5, the committee should also endeavour to engage with Standing Committee on Finance, the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, to ensure that the process is supported and recommendations affecting their mandate could be effective. But that is our normal process anyway. It's nothing new. The following resources will be required: a parliamentary legal advisor, senior legal counsel with contract law background, if necessary. Phrase if necessary was added after discussions with table staff and my own senior management in Parliament, who said, look, let's see how it is first before you go jumping and saying you want to do this, that, and the next thing. Have a look and see how much cooperation are you actually getting here. Technical industry manufacturing specialists, we do need that. There is absolutely no doubt. With an understanding of the value chain and South Africa's manufacturing capabilities. So there it is with those of you who may have joined the committee this year. You will see you've actually got a schedule to and through the entities, all of them. Okay? The next schedule here, you've got a list of designated sectors. I think that's going to be helpful to all of us. So I really think we can thank the staff for crafting this for us. And I really would appreciate it if we can move forward now on this and get a recommendation. Thanks, Honourable Williams. So I'm just recognising hands. I'm not saying that you're going to propose adoption. Thanks, Honourable Williams. Followed now. When you're going that route, now I'm going that route as well. Followed by the Honourable Montash, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Thunwiki, in that order.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I think that on page 4, section 3.1, the scope of the inquiry, and also on page 6, the schedules, I think that we need to include local government bodies like SELGA or some local government structures must be included because of procurement from local government, in particular with regard to the list of designated sectors. There's things like furniture products. So we can get local government to explain why they haven't bought local furniture since 2012. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just looking at staff to see whether they're noting that and so on. Right. Honourable Montash.
Can you check us out on page 4?
Yeah.
On under the activities and visions. I would personally don't close our space into transmit and transfer. I'd rather stay on state owned enterprises because they all come to not observing the localization.
We can, but I think it would be wise for us to look at the designations. And on the first principle, which we said, let's look at those that have been going 3 years or more, you know. And I'm having a very quick look here. You've got a whole lot. You've got things like pylons. What's that? Power pylons, you know, 2012 and that sort of thing. So I think the principle remains there, and that we should be guided by those with at least a three-year track so we can investigate that lot. But it is noted, Honourable Montash, thank you. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chairperson. I did send yourself and Mr. Herman an email yesterday.
Yes, you did, it's right here.
Thank you. Detailing what I'd like to see in this, and most of it is there. But I think that it would also be important to name people who actually may not be in the employed by these state-owned enterprises anymore. And I had mentioned a number of individuals, and I hope that that we can still include those individuals in there, because specifically with respect to Transnet, those individuals on the board play very, very influential roles in ensuring that that the tenders were awarded to these big four companies. And I think that it's important that they appear before us and explain their rationale in how they came to some of their conclusions and account for some of the activities preceding those tenders. With respect to page 4, under the scope of the inquiry 3.1, I would think, Chair, that the only people who need to meet in camera would be those specific businesses that do business with the state but have very clear evidence of how they have been marginalised or overlooked, and how business has been awarded to other companies that fail to meet local procurement requirements, and that would obviously be to protect them, so that their businesses are not threatened. I want to understand why, I'd like to get an idea from you what you believe would be sub judice. What are those matters? If you could please list those for me. With respect to the planned activities, I don't believe that any of the stakeholders actually need to be briefed by us. I think that they're well aware of what we are doing. In fact, Mr. Garmer spoke at the Transnet in Derby yesterday and told everyone what we're up to. So I don't think that we actually need to sit down and brief them, ask them to play nice. So either must or they don't have to. It's up to them. So I'm not sure why you see the need for that to take place. I want to support Honourable Williams's proposal that local government is included, and they're one of the biggest spenders in the spheres of state. And also, I think it would be very important, Chair, to include, and I had put it in my email, that organisations, investigative journalists, organisations, writers that have investigated these issues, that we call on them to also come and provide information. I know that the Amma Bongani investigative journalists have done some exceptional work on this Transnet and CSR contract, and I think that we would gain a lot of mileage and assistance by having them present to us.
Thank you for your input, Honourable Maxwell. Much of what you've said in any event would be covered by the term other stakeholders, so that as and when we reach on the State of Business Committee, Honourable Bungwini.
Colloquial understanding of the
Okay.
Sorry. my question.
Which one is that, Honourable
Mac? It wasn't my question. It said, however, the committee's inquiry will be limited by a number of matters which are sub judice. That is a statement of fact. What are those matters?
You see, the thing is that those matters that are I would like to see that, because as I understood it, as we pursue this inquiry, we're going to be dealing with, let's have an example, the wheels of the transnet or something. That's what we're going to pursue. If out of the blue someone takes transnet to court on specifically that issue, even though we were pursuing it, we would have to wait. That is how I understand it. Because now it's written, and we can't stop people from taking issues the court process. We can't. So, as I sit here, I can't give you a whole list of issues, because they're not before the court, you see. And as this inquiry will only start next year, you're looking at least 3 months away. Honourable MacPherson?
Thanks. Well, then,
Honourable,
you need to do is reword it then. And it's because it rewords it that there are a number of matters. It's worded currently that there are a number of matters which are sub judice. So it should be, should a matter come before the court, the committee will.
All right, let's give you this perhaps recrafting. The same on page 4, just above planned activities. However, the committee's inquiry may rather than will. So maybe that's how it should be. Maybe. Limited, if any, you know, matters are sub judice. So, you know, it may be. There's something in the realm of the future.
Sure.
All right. Are we happy with that? Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to say I disagree with Honourable MacPherson about individuals that don't work for entities anymore. Not because I don't think that these individuals should be questioned, but I think that they shouldn't be questioned in this inquiry, because we're talking about localization and not about perceived corruption or corruption, depending on what that is. I'm not saying that, I'm going to say it again, I'm not saying those individuals shouldn't be, you know, talked, questioned in some forum, but not in our forum, because it's going to move away from our point of this inquiry. We're going to move into a corruption inquiry as opposed to a localization inquiry. And I don't think that that's what we want to do, because we could lose out badly, because if we lose direction on this, then localization just falls away and eventually we get no local content. And that, I think we should stick to the localization slot on this inquiry. Thank you.
Right, now we've had that. We've been around on this. I'm going to allow you a final comment, but specifically on what we've just heard on the
election. Well, I mean, I think the important point is, and let's be frank, we need to understand why there were no penalty clauses for failure to meet local content. Now, those individuals who negotiated those contracts are no longer working for Transnet. We need to call them here. We need to understand why they did that. But if there's no provision for that, we can't do so. So, you know, I disagree with you, Honourable Williams, and maybe you misunderstood me, but there are certain individuals that I have sent you a list of that need to come and explain how those contracts were negotiated and why they were negotiated in the way that they were.
Yes, I do have your letter here, and as a matter of fact, I did go through it very carefully.
Didn't get a response.
It's a one-pager, a raised response somewhat. And there's a long list of different people here. But I think the main issue, I'm not saying you can't make reference as we're going through our inquiry, but we have a singular purpose here. Other committees here have other purposes, other inquiries. There is indeed an inquiry that's likely to be capturing precisely this. But let that be. Our inquiry is pursuing, and I'll repeat what Honourable Williams has said, ours is deeply concerned with public procurement, its relationship to localization and employment. And that is the route we are going to pursue in great detail and ruthlessly, in fact. If it means that in the pursuit of that we find, there's no way we can continue with this without engaging with this person. That is another issue. And the terms of reference would not preclude that if should it arrive. I think that should be clear. What is our main focus? But I want to address the issue of why bother to invite them? Why? When I came here, most of the departments at national level had not the faintest clue how to be of value to the committee when exercising oversight on its budget. Gave us reams, pages, boxes of documents we couldn't use. So for us to do our job effectively, a constitutional obligation, we brought in the department. Then we would send them letters. This is what we want done. This is how we want it delivered to us. So it can be helpful. And I must say, consequently, it has been extremely helpful. And here, I would like to be able to spell out, and for committee members, to be able to spell out exactly the nature of our inquiry. Because even here, it would seem as if we move in that direction. If we want to pursue something and get results, and we want to be ruthless, it's like fighting a war. You don't fight a war on five fronts. You want to win that war with limited resources. You spearhead and move with one block, and you take over in that area. That's right. There we are. See, another military veteran, as it were. No, but on a more serious note, on a more China. The point I'm trying to make is I don't think we should dilute this inquiry. We need to focus it if we're going to get results. So I am appealing to everyone. You will be allowed latitude, Honourable Macpherson, as will everyone. And let us move now to a position where we can adopt with a couple of amendments we've made. Can I have someone to propose adoption? Honourable Montash, is this a clarification?
It's not a clarification, it's just a question of ground for a more question.
Thank you very much. Can we have someone to second it? Honourable Williams? Thank you. Those are the terms of reference then. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the next item. And that is South African Farmers Development Association. It's my intention to distribute to members present there the documents that were handed out. I'm sure everyone has received them by now. The documents that were handed out that day. Yes. So there was a pack coming to members, all right? But essentially, we wanted within that committee to be able to get all stakeholders, but at least to get the DTI to tell us what is going on. Give us a progress report. And during that meeting, if I'm not mistaken, I chaired, the Honourable Kecharia was present. Who else was there? There were five people, Honourable Tioko, Honourable Van Skalkbeek, three, four. Who was the fifth one?
Shivambu.
No, not Shivambu. Dlamini. Honourable Dlamini. Yeah, there we are. And as you know, we couldn't take a decision. We didn't have a quorum. So we said we would bring it to the next committee meeting. Essentially, the idea was to ask the DTI, for example, to please give us a progress report. What has happened? Because this old legislation, which harks back to 1930-something, which was amended in 1978, I recall off the top of my head, it really only changed one point. It's the smallest piece of principal legislation, the 1938, on the books. And when it was amended, it was simply to say blacks will no longer be classified as illegal if they farm, or words to that effect. So there's very little change in it.
and it remains under the sugar industry, is under trade and industry, and trade and industry attempted to deal with it, but their instructions were, even though they'd been negotiated and signed, were not implemented. That was the VTI. We're waiting. We may have it, but I haven't looked at it. The other thing we asked for here, and this I asked